Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is Nicole Hannah-Jones, creator of the 1619 Project from the New York Times Magazine. The project makes a case that you don't often hear in history textbooks, that slavery was foundational to America. So it wasn't surprising that we ignited a fierce debate among historians about these issues. But that's the power of the New York Times, to spark an important dialogue with bold, rigorous reporting that forces us to examine our assumptions. To learn more, go to nytimes.com/worthit.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Emilio San Pedro, and in the early hours of Wednesday, the 12th of February, these are our main stories. Sudan has agreed to surrender the former president Omar al-Bashir to the International Criminal Court. The World Health Organization has urged the world to fight as aggressively as possible the coronavirus, now named COVID-19. Spain's High Court has upheld a company's right to deduct from employees' working day the time they take for breaks. Also in this podcast, music fans pay their respects to Joseph Shabalala, the founder of Ladysmith Black Mambazo, who's died. And an investigation by the Washington Post and a German broadcaster has revealed that a major manufacturer of encryption devices was secretly owned by the CIA and West German intelligence. We begin with an announcement that appears hugely significant and a stunning reversal. It comes from Sudan, where the authorities say they've agreed to hand over the former president Omar al-Bashir to the International Criminal Court to face charges of genocide and war crimes. Bashir was ousted in April last year after wielding power for 30 years. It was back in 2009 that the ICC charged the then president with war crimes for overseeing his government's brutal counterinsurgency in the Darfur region some years before that. An estimated 300,000 people died and millions were displaced. Now representatives of the new Sovereign Council, a mix of military and civilian figures, have announced that they're willing for Mr. Bashir and three others indicted by the ICC to appear before the court. A member of that Sovereign Council, Mohammed Al-Hassan Al-Taishi, spoke to the BBC about the decision.
This revolution is about justice, and we are doing what the Sudanese people are asking us to do. We are working very hard to reach a comprehensive peace agreement, and we're trying to fix our country's problem, to prepare our country for the future.
Our Deputy Africa Editor Anne Soy has this assessment of what's happened.
It is a huge development for Sudan and for the people of Darfur. The announcement was made in the morning by the spokesperson of the Transitional Military Council, basically the council that is currently running Sudan. He was in Juba when he made that announcement, saying that he had reached that agreement and they would be handing over Omar al-Bashir to the International Criminal Court. Now, it's been a long time coming. Omar al-Bashir was indicted for war crimes and crimes against humanity, including genocide in the Darfur, crimes that were committed between 2003 and around 2010. There were two arrest warrants against him by the International Criminal Court issued in 2009 and 2010, but they were largely ignored. He continued to travel across Africa and the Middle East. Countries that are members of the ICC did not hand him over. In some cases, the governments were taken to court, to their local courts in their countries, but still, until now, there hasn't been any willingness to hand him over to the ICC, and that's why this is a major development.
And Soy. Omar al-Bashir became the world's first sitting leader to be indicted by the court for crimes against humanity after the conflict in the Darfur region killed hundreds of thousands of people. A government militia known as the Janjaweed was held responsible for many of the killings. But after the genocide, it rebranded itself as the Rapid Support Forces and became an integral part of the power structure in Khartoum. Even though many Darfuris took part in the uprising to topple Omar al-Bashir, the legacy of the Janjaweed still hangs over Darfur itself. The BBC's Mohamed Hashim is one of the first journalists to travel freely around Darfur in 10 years. This is his report.
These were the defining chants of the revolution. Thousands of Darfuri activists took part in the uprising that ousted Bashir. Activists like Bumban.
It took 3 or 4 days to get here. The revolution was all over Sudan. Yet the government targeted Darfuris. They used us as scapegoats to distract attention from the protests. They called us all sorts of things, including terrorists and infiltrators. But the protesters stood up to Bashir. They told him he was an arrogant racist and that everyone supported Darfur.
Bumban left the IDP camp he was living in and came to Khartoum to take part in the uprising. But what about those left behind in Darfur? To find out, I went to Niala, the capital of South Darfur and the country's second largest city.
Last time I was here was in 2007-08. The camp was new then, and it was very insecure. There were many incidents being reported, and the government used to attack the camp regularly. Now, it feels like a safe settlement. It feels like a city, which has its markets, where people are getting on about their daily lives.
We went to visit Kalma, the largest of Darfur's 175 camps. Kalma is a sprawling camp perched on the edges of the desert, surrounded by glades of baobab, and the solitary train track to nowhere runs past the camp. Nearly 2 million Darfuris were forced to flee their homes during the war, and they have lived in camps like Kalma ever since. People like Ilyas, a volunteer teacher by day and a barber in the afternoon. In the sweltering heat, I found Ilyas in a small mud hut, decorated in sky blue paint that was peeling off the walls. Posters of Steven Gerrard and Ronaldinho adorned the shop. Ilyas was 19 when he came to Kalma in 2004. He wore the scars of war on his face.
One of the Janjaweed fighters saw that I was from a different area. He called me a slave, and another soldier pushed me, and I fell face first into the fire.
For people like Ni'mat, an IDP who is trained as a midwife, things haven't changed.
The situation is not improving. Things improve when there is work and people here have no work. If people want to farm, they don't have the means. You only work on day-by-day basis. Whatever you make, that is your children's sustenance. They said the new government will make things better, but we've not seen any changes.
We're about to go and introduce ourselves to the local sheikhs who oversee this camp. Assalamu alaikum.
The sheikhs were adamant they will not go back to their homes until conditions improved.
So Sheikh Ishaq just made the demands of the people in this camp. They want the handing over of former President Bashir to the ICC and his cohorts. He is calling for the disarmament of all the Janjaweed forces, resettlement in the villages where they were displaced from. And he says all the foreign settlers who have made them prisoners in their own land have to return to their countries.
Back in Niala, any visitor to the cities in Darfur can see the rapid support for soldiers. The rebranded Janjaweed, some of them have served in Yemen or were heading there. They bring in money. This is evident in the urban sprawl of cities like Niala and Al-Fashir, where the markets are booming and vehicles smuggled from Libya fill up the dusty lanes. When I ask people about how they see them, many avoided answering directly. But the recent spat of ethnic violence in Jenina in western Darfur shows how volatile the region still remains. If the revolution to oust Bashir is to mean anything, people here tell me the crimes perpetrated in Darfur must not go unpunished.
Mohamed Hashim reporting from Darfur. The Swiss authorities say they're investigating allegations that a company based in Switzerland, which makes encryption devices, was for decades a front operated by the CIA and West German intelligence to spy on over 100 countries. The Washington Post, which uncovered the story together with Germany's ZDF public broadcaster, is calling it the intelligence coup of the century. I found out more from our technology correspondent, Rory Kethlen-Jones.
They're quoting in that line, the intelligence coup of the century, a classified CIA history of this extraordinary operation. What we're talking about is a world-leading company selling encryption devices, basically code-making machines, with a history going back to World War II. The company's called Crypto AG. It's a Swiss company. And over the years, it's had customers in over 120 countries, everyone from Iran to military governments in Latin America, even the Vatican. But the investigation by the Washington Post and ZDF, a German broadcaster, has basically found that it was secretly owned for decades by the CIA and by West German intelligence. And the encryption devices it sold were rigged so that the spy agencies could effectively listen in.
So intelligence agencies were effectively then snooping on over 100 countries, both allies and enemies.
Exactly. And according to some of the documents, at one stage, 40% of diplomatic cables, you know, the vital tool by which countries communicate secretly, were using this encryption equipment, which, of course, was not secure.
Now, many of us have in our devices, on our phones or our tablets, we have apps like WhatsApp and Skype and Telegram even that people have that promote themselves as being a good place for you to go and have a very private, encrypted conversation. In fact, it says it at the very top on some of them, at the very top of the page. So does this raise questions about those services too?
Well, I think what one can assume is that encryption is a kind of arms race between companies that provide it, and most companies, let's be frank, are not owned by the CIA, but between companies that provide it and intelligence agencies that want to crack it. So one shouldn't necessarily be too concerned that your WhatsApp messages are being listened to by GCHQ or the CIA or any other intelligence agency, but they are trying. They're trying their best to make private communication, which you believe is completely secure, as insecure as possible, because that is their mission. Their mission is to find out what their targets are saying, and encryption is the battleground for that contest.
Rory Kethlen-Jones, there's a new name for the coronavirus that began in Wuhan in China, COVID-19. The World Health Organization said this new official name avoids stigmatization and confusion, as the word coronavirus actually refers to the group of viruses it belongs to rather than to the latest strain. The WHO says it could be 18 months before the first vaccine becomes available. At an emergency meeting in Geneva, the Director General of the WHO, Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, described COVID-19 as public enemy number one.
Outbreaks can bring serious upheavals, serious consequences to the world. It's not just a health security issue. It's a matter of political, social and economic upheavals. It can affect all areas of society. And that's why we have to take it seriously. You know, the world, when it talks about terrorism, to be honest, a virus is more powerful in creating political, economic, and social upheaval than any terrorist attack.
More than 1,000 people have now died from the disease in China, but the authorities there say the number of new infections fell by nearly 20% on Monday compared with Sunday. The first senior local government officials have been sacked following their highly criticized response to the epidemic. Our China correspondent, Stephen McDonnell, reports from Beijing.
Following outrage on social media over the handling of China's coronavirus emergency, the axe is starting to fall. The top two leaders from Hubei's Provincial Health Commission have been sacked, and most observers don't expect the fallout to stop there. One leading epidemiologist, Zhong Nanshan, who became known internationally for combating the SARS virus in 2003, says he can understand why these officials are being punished.
I should say the local healthcare authority should have some responsibility on this. because at this time, although some small cluster had discovered, the local government, local health authority, their work had not been doing well.
Hunan's mayor has also been heavily criticised for the city's tardy approach to releasing information, even after it became clear that a major health emergency was unfolding. In apologising for initially holding back news of the virus, Zhou Xianwang said he didn't have clearance to do so from above. Then there's the case of a doctor who was castigated by police after he tried to sound an early warning about the potential danger. He died last week after being infected by his patients. This has all led to questions about the Communist Party's command and control structure under President Xi Jinping. Critics say an obsession with stability and perceived need to silence troublemakers are trumping the public good. Given this dangerous political climate, it seems likely more heads will roll.
Steve McDonnell. With at least 45 people suffering from the illness, Singapore has the highest number of confirmed cases outside China. It is also the place where at least 3 international travellers caught the virus whilst attending a sales conference. This includes a British national who, it appears, then passed the virus on to several others when he flew back to Europe. In recent days, several countries have slapped travel advisories on Singapore. Our correspondent Karishma Waswani asked Lawrence Wong, the co-chair of Singapore's task force on COVID-19, how much of a worry this is.
We are vulnerable, but we have to do everything we can to contain that spread of the virus even within Singapore. We have stepped up extra precautions. We have raised our alert levels. Within Singapore, we have been stepping up our surveillance. So our doctors are proactively doing more testing of cases, even for cases without any prior links to China. And that's one of the reasons why we are starting to pick up more cases now.
Is Singapore potentially a gateway to the international spread of this virus?
Well, we are very mindful that we are indeed an open economy. We are an international travel hub. So we are doing all we can to contain that spread. We are putting out information in a very transparent manner, and we continue to work with all health authorities overseas in order to contain the further spread of the virus. I think that is vital. International cooperation will be vital in tackling this international public health emergency.
But there are other countries that are beginning to put travel advisories in place on Singapore. What's your message to other nations that are getting worried?
Each country will have to look at the situation as it evolves globally. Within Singapore, if indeed there is widespread community transmission, we will do everything we can to contain it. And certainly, if you talk about outbound travellers, we will also be screening them and checking them to make sure that they are in good health before they leave Singapore.
What is your assessment of China's response to this public health crisis?
I think they are going all out to try and defeat the virus. They have taken very stringent measures, including restricting outbound travel. And that has helped in many ways to contain the spread of the virus to other countries. It is spreading, but imagine if they had not done some of the very drastic and stringent measures that they had imposed earlier. I think the spread would have been a lot more than what we are seeing today.
Lawrence Wong of Singapore's Task Force on COVID-19. Spain's High Court has upheld a company's right to deduct from employees' working day the time they take for breaks for cigarettes, coffee and breakfast. The case had been brought by a trade union against the energy company Galp. Our Europe regional editor, Danny Eberhard, has more.
Nipping out of the office or factory for a quick cigarette or a cup of coffee and a chat with a colleague. For millions of people across the world, it's part of a normal working day. But in Spain, at least, don't expect your employer to pay for your time. The Spanish subsidiary of Galp said it only applied to breaks taken outside its premises, and that the company had merely been implementing Spanish law. Recent changes required companies there to record workers' arrival and leaving times, in part to ensure employees were not being exploited, but also to facilitate greater flexibility in working contracted hours. For the unions, at least, this appears to be one unwanted downside. The union that brought the action is fuming. It says it will appeal, calling the ruling a fraud by law that puts obstacles in the way of employees enjoying a hard-won right to regulate working hours.
Danny Eberhard. Still to come in this podcast, the first same-sex marriage takes place in Northern Ireland after a landmark change in the law.
It's just a show that we are equal to a man and a woman. Our love is just the same. It's no different. I can finally say she is my wife.
That's coming up. But first, it's often referred to as the lungs of the planet. But now, scientists say part of the Amazon rainforest has started to emit more carbon dioxide than it absorbs. The researchers from Brazil's National Institute for Space Research say an area in the southeast is losing this ability, which is vital to combat climate change. Our correspondent, Gabriel Gatehouse, has seen the research.
Well, basically, the Amazon is what's known as a carbon sink. It takes carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. In the 90s, it took about 2 billion tons of carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere every year. That's now down to about 1 billion, 1.2 billion. But these figures are usually the results of estimates. What we've seen is the results of actual real study of something. So over a period of 10 years, the researchers flew aeroplanes over different parts of the Amazon, collecting samples of the air and measuring the carbon dioxide. And what they found, that while the majority of the Amazon rainforest still acts as quite a strong carbon sink, this portion, about one-fifth of the total area in the southeast, is now emitting more carbon than it absorbs. So over all the years of the study, it was a net source of carbon. And this is something that's very worrying to scientists who for a long time have talked about an Amazon tipping point, the point at which the forest can no longer renew itself and it starts to become overall a net source of carbon. I spoke to Professor Carlos Nobre. He's one of the co-authors of this study, and he's also Brazil's leading expert on the Amazon.
This is a very, very worrying observation, because it could be showing the beginnings of a major tipping point. In our calculations, if we exceeded 20 to 25% of deforestation in the Amazon, today we are at about 17%. And global warming continues unabated with high emission scenarios, then the tipping point would be reached.
Professor Carlos Nobre there from the University of São Paulo. And Gabriel, Brazil's President Jair Bolsonaro is quite bullish, isn't he, about any criticism. And he's, for the most part, been on the side of those who would want to develop the Amazon further. So can this change anything?
Well, that's right. I mean, President Bolsonaro has been very clear. He wants development rather than conservation. He wants people to make money out of the Amazon. Now, scientists agree that this tipping point is a thing. They just disagree on when it might happen. Some think you need to get to 3 degrees of warming, which would mean end of the century, basically. Others, like Carlos Nobre, say 20 to 25% of deforestation, which would mean in the next decade or so. But this research suggests we're closer than perhaps initially thought. And whether that will spur Bolsonaro into action, I think, is quite doubtful at this point.
Gabriel Gatehouse. And now a correction. In the Global News podcast dated the 19th of August 2019, we reported on the death of Eric Garner. He died in New York in July 2014 after being put in a chokehold by the police officer who arrested him. Video footage of the incident generated widespread national attention and raised questions about the appropriate use of force by law enforcement. In our report, we wrongly stated that Mr. Garner had been arrested for selling loose cigarettes. This was incorrect. Mr. Garner denied it when questioned at the scene, and following his murder, no charges were pursued. We should have said that he was arrested on suspicion of selling single cigarettes, and we apologize for this mistake. A couple from the city of Belfast have become history makers after tying the knot in the first same-sex marriage to take place in Northern Ireland. The women's wedding took place in a hotel in County Antrim after a landmark change in the law. Here's our Ireland correspondent, Emma Vardy.
Legalising same-sex marriage in Northern Ireland has involved a long and controversial journey after it had previously been blocked by the Democratic Unionist Party. Eventually, the law was changed when Westminster MPs intervened, 6 years after the rest of the UK, while there was no devolved government at Stormont. Robin Peoples and Sharni Edwards said they were delighted to be able to have their wedding as the first of the ceremonies to take place in Northern Ireland this week. Sharni Edwards, a waitress from Brighton, said they hadn't set out to make history, but had just fallen in love. And speaking to the media at the ceremony, Robin Peoples said the change in the law gave them equality.
It's just to show that we are equal to a man and a woman. Our love is just the same. It's no different. I can finally say she is my wife.
It marks a time of social change in Northern Ireland, with abortion also being decriminalised.
Emma Vardy. Music fans from around the world have been paying their respects to Joseph Shabalala, the founder of Ladysmith Black Mambazo, who's died at the age of 78. The South African group helped to introduce traditional Zulu choral music to a global audience. Ladysmith Black Mambazo featured prominently on Paul Simon's album Graceland. Andrew Harding looks back at Joseph Shabalala's life.
It was a specific sound, he said, that he'd heard in his dreams. Close harmony singing in the Zulu language and tradition.
I started while I was young, about 12, making noise. Mama was, "Hey, don't make noise." And when I stopped, and said, "Oh, carry on doing, my boy."
Joseph Shabalala recruited several relatives, and by the 1970s, they perfected those harmonies to such an extent that they were banned from entering any more local singing competitions. Their group, Ladysmith Black Mambazo, became a sensation in apartheid South Africa. But it was in 1985 that their fortunes changed dramatically. The American singer Paul Simon came to the country ignoring a cultural boycott, scouting for talent for his Graceland album. Somebody
cry, why? When we met Paul Simon, everybody was excited. We practiced until 12 midnight. And then he said, "This is what I was looking for."
The result and the exposure turned Ladysmith Black Mambazo into an international phenomenon. Soon, Nelson Mandela, freed from prison, was celebrating the group as cultural ambassadors for a newly democratic South Africa. Joseph Shabalala's brother and later his wife were both murdered in a country that often tested the gentle, unwavering optimism of his music. But Ladysmith Black Mambazo kept singing and touring the world, winning 5 Grammys, the last in 2018. In his final years, Joseph Shabalala left the touring to his younger relatives. They're currently in California. The family's music and its message of hope must, he said, never be silenced. He stayed at home, teaching South African children about those insistent Zulu harmonies that had once appeared to him in his dreams.
Africa. I don't know how to say it, but we say thank you to our people, to everybody, and thank to the Lord.
Andrew Harding on the life of Joseph Shabalala of Ladysmith Black Mambazo, who's died at the age of 78. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. And if you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Emilio San Pedro. Until next time, goodbye. Thank you.